again, my friends. This is Tim Benal with BenalofAmerica.com's original audio series, Benal of America Audio, Season 1. This week, we continue with the Greg Bishop interview, Part 2 of 2. A little bit of in-house notes before we do the bio and rock out on the interview, and that is that we are hard at work on a streaming audio system, and we hope to have it to BenalofAmerica.com by next weekend, the 29th of October. So hopefully, if you're listening to this, check out BenalofAmerica.com, and soon you will be able just to listen and not have to download, and we'll add a whole new dimension to Benal of America Audio Season 1 as we enter the second half of this monumental audio series. And now, a little bit about Greg Bishop before we rock out on the interview. He is the editor and publisher of The Excluded Middle. I believe he also writes some of the articles for it. It is an esoteric journal. And also, he is the host of Radio Mysterioso, and that is an online esoteric radio show. And, of course, he's the author of Project Beta, the story of Paul Benowitz, national security, and the creation of a modern UFO myth. That is pretty much what we're talking about this week here at Benal of America Audio. And you can also check out Greg Bishop's website at www.excludedmiddle.com. That's excludedmiddle.com. This entire portion was recorded on August 24th, 2005. Let's take it away. Greg Bishop, Part 2 of 2 on Benal of America Audio, Season 1.
All right, so Bill Moore, after he gave the big speech and the revelation at the UFO convention, do you think ufology learned anything from his experience?
They did, but it took about a decade to do it, I think.
And what, for the first decade they were just mad and jealous?
I think jealousy is one that is put in there too. I mean, I hate to bring up that word, but yeah, I think they were jealous. I mean, the people that were hovering around that information were suddenly told that it was all complete crap and was made up. Now, that's what they were basing their worldview on, so it was a little tough to take. And other people, and another, in the second echelon, was, we trusted this guy, and now he tells us that he was reporting it on us to the government. So they didn't want to have anything to do with him. And then, you know, kind of the rank and file, they went along with the first two levels. You can't trust anything he says because he's just told us everything that happened, which I thought was kind of weird. If he's telling you what happened and admitting to it, does that mean he's lying all the time?
Yes.
Was he lying to them about lying to them?
Yeah.
It confused a lot of people, but this is where that excluded middle, the two sides of the issue thing comes along. You know, if you can listen to somebody and not have this filter on where you're immediately throwing out something and not listening to it because you don't like it, and then accepting the other things that seem to agree with your prejudices, you're never going to get anywhere. And I think people in ufology, one, have had time to be circumspect about what happened, and two, a lot of younger people are coming up that, I was 25 when that happened. And there's a lot of people coming up now that weren't around then or weren't involved, and they've got a different mindset about what's going on and a different way of looking at it. So they're able to say, look at what he did and what can we learn from it, which is what Bill was asking people to do in the first place. And that next wave of people, like you and Nick Redfern and I'm trying to think of other people.
Greenwald.
Yeah, Greenwald. Greenwald, I tend to think, is kind of a black and white type of person, but I don't know him too well.
I just meant he's part of a young generation.
Yeah, exactly. But for the most part, those kind of people, they don't have the prejudices that the generation before it had. I mean, it happens in anything, in any field. And they're trying to look at new ways to look at things, and one of those involves listening to somebody that everybody thought was a pariah before and seeing what they can get out of it.
So was he blackballed from ufology pretty much, or was it sort of?
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow.
Nobody wanted to talk to him for a long time. In fact, up to when he just stopped, I think most people just didn't want to deal with him. And he did not make an effort to go out and communicate with people because he figured if somebody had something to say, they'd come to him, which is what happened.
Now, he was, I would assume he was pretty tight with Stan Friedman because they wrote the first book and they were involved in the MJ-12 documents. Did he ever give any indication of what Friedman's reaction to this whole thing was?
Friedman sort of knew what was going on because they were close enough that he knew that there was, he was getting inside information. I don't know if he knew he was trading it for, you know, reports on people, but Bill didn't sit there and type up reports and say so-and-so went to his house and then he met with his wife and, you know, and then he cheated on her and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
What happened was they would just ask him, you know, so-and-so over at MUFON, you talked to them recently. Did they know anything about this? Do they know anything about what? The Nellis Range. It seems like they're interested in it. What did they say about it? And he'd say, well, they said this and this and this and this. And as long as there was nothing in there that looked dangerous, they'd just say, okay, fine. I'm sure these people had files on them, and I have a file on me, and you do, and Bill does. But, you know, so what? But that was their agreement. And Stan, I'm sure, does too. And Stan Friedman, he and Bill got in some sort of an argument later over something I can't even remember. And after that, they stopped talking. They don't hate each other or anything. They just, you know, they stopped working together. And Stan's still going at it, and Bill isn't, which is another reason why they're just not really in communication.
And what about the other guy that is?
He's Jamie Chandray?
Yeah, he's almost a trivia question answer at this point. He's really disappeared from the field.
I love that story. You know, in 99, I think, I started talking to him extensively. I guess Bill, like, introduced me or something. We started talking on the phone. And, like, once every 2 or 3 months we'd call up, and I'd say, you know, what about this, or what have you found out, or, you know. And we'd just talk about various subjects. I don't think I ever met him face-to-face but one time. The rest of the time it was just phone contacts, and I said, would you like to do an interview for the magazine? Because at that point I was thinking I'd put out another issue. And if he had talked to me, I probably would have. He said, yeah, sure. You know, this is in November, October. He said, I'm going to go to New York, and I'll be back in December, and we'll do it then. I said, okay. And I never heard from him again. And I called his house, and his number was changed. And it was changed very quickly. I called his house, and there was a message on a machine. There was a machine with some woman's voice saying, this is whatever number. If you're calling for somebody named Jamie or Chandera or Chandray, I don't know who he is or where he went.
Wow.
They didn't have a forwarding number or anything. They just reassigned the number to some woman very quickly, within like a month. And I never heard what happened to him. Although recently, I found out he still lives in L.A., and he just dropped out of the UFO field. The funny thing was, the last thing he told me before he disappeared was, I don't know how we got on the subject, very easily, but he said, I know there's an alien presence here, and I know the government knows about it.
So, like,
I said, well, how can you be so sure, Jamie? I mean, he said, I was shown something that made me believe that. And so I'm thinking, is he telling me this to make me think he thinks that, or does he actually believe it? I said, well, what was it? And he said, I can't tell you. Part of the agreement was that I don't talk about what it was. He said, however, if you guess what it is, I'll tell you that you're right.
Huh.
So that was the last thing we were talking about. So over the next couple of months, that subject, I just, you know, I said, did you see a craft? Did you shake hands with an alien? You know, obviously if you saw a film, it could have been faked. You know, was it some, was it a document? It's no, 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 no. And finally I said, Jamie, I think I've gone through everything. You're asking me for something that sounds like a religious belief. He goes, no, I was shown something. It was real. And I was never able to guess it. And then he disappeared.
And you haven't talked to him since?
Nope. Although I know he lives in L.A., and I have a strong suspicion that he really doesn't want to talk to anybody about it. Kind of like Al Bender, who disappeared years ago after the Men in Black thing. He still lives in L.A. I believe he may still be alive. He's probably in his 70s. But if you even mention UFOs to the guy, he'll throw you out of the house, I've heard.
Wow.
But Jamie, I think he just, what I think is he was shown this thing and told, and he had been involved with the government back to the 60s as kind of a contract worker on various things. Like the first thing he did was some kind of audio tape analysis of a soldier in a court-martial case to try and determine whether his voice was faked on the phone or something. And he actually testified for the government in that case as a, you know, as an expert witness. And Bill told me this because he said one time they were at a meeting and somebody from the CIA thing, I said, turned to Bill and said, you're new, I haven't seen you before, but you, and he turned to Jamie and pointed to him, we've known about you since the 1960s. Quite a long time. And Bill kind of said, what? Who? What? He had no idea. He just thought he was a new, you know, a TV producer that he'd met.
Yeah. Wow.
And so I didn't emphasize it in the book because there's just too many stories, but him and Bill worked quite closely together on a lot of this stuff, and they knew the same people and talked to the same people. And in fact, Bill and Jamie were the ones that came up with that aviary thing so they could talk about all these contacts they had without having to worry about revealing their identities. Hawk and Falcon and Sparrow and, you know, all these people.
All right, well, that actually is a question here. I'm going to jump right to that one then. The aviary, now, as soon as I read that part in the book, I immediately flashed to the Bill Cooper book, because he has a section on where he dubs a group the aviary, but in his version, they're all ufologists.
I think some of them were ufologists. Not all of them, but a couple.
And what I was going to ask is, well, he pretty much said the aviary was all ufologists. And he listened.
Bill Cooper also believed the protocols of the Elders of Zion and thought that the driver in the Kennedy assassination was the one that shot Kennedy.
Okay, well, I was going to ask you about Bill Cooper in general, so let's talk about him, because he's gone now. He kind of, he passed away before the internet boom, and he sort of got missed out on this big explosion of information. Now he's sort of another guy who's sort of fallen into the cracks that you don't even hear about much anymore. You probably know more than I do about him, so give me a little information about Bill Cooper.
Well, not much more, but sometime in the... Actually, in Linda Howe's book, it reminded me in her first book on the cattle mutilation thing, Strange Harvest, she worked with Bill Cooper pretty closely, and he said that he'd seen... Somehow he remembered verbatim some document that he had seen while he was working for, what was it, for the Coast Guard or for the Navy? Yeah, it was for the Navy. He said he had seen some document that had to do with UFOs. It was kind of like the Bob Dean scenario.
Yeah.
And somehow, I don't know how, he remembered every word of it verbatim and told it to her. And they typed it up to make it look all official, like it was a real document, even though they didn't claim that it was. And published it in her book. Like I said, like a lot of these other people, that's fine, but there's no way to prove any of it. And the funny thing was, a lot of it was based on things that had come out after that that looked like they were actually just lifted from other documents that had been released. So, you know, in his mind, that was because, you know, that made it real. It means that, you know, there was cross-reference, but to me, it just, the stuff that he'd read and dumped in there, consciously or not. I'm sorry, I just don't have a really high opinion of Bill Cooper. He's just one of those people that would believe everything, as in Benowitz's case, but he was a lot more shrill. He would believe everything that squared up with what he thought was going on and discount everything that didn't, even if it was proven and, you know, most of the population believed it and any reasonable person would, he just wouldn't do it. So it's, you know, you're talking to somebody that just has a delusional idea about what's going on and then basing, you know, an entire book and his entire life on this illusory thing. And there were certainly parts of it that were real. There was a Protocols of the Elders of Zion, but most people think it was propaganda to make people think that there were a bunch of Jewish bankers taking over the world and planning this in the late 19th century. But he believed it was actually real. The unfortunate thing is a lot of anti-Semitic people and Nazis and everybody else believe this too. Doesn't make it wrong, but it hasn't been proved to be anything else but what I think it is, which was just a provocational thing put out by a bunch of people who are anti-Jewish. Not that I'm Jewish or anything, but it doesn't, you know, if something doesn't square up from more than one dimension, it's kind of hard to support it. And Bill Cooper, anything from his dimension that made sense to him was true.
Well, from what I, when I read the book, his book, I kind of thought he must have, if I was going to surmise.
Let's say I never read the book, so I might.
All right. That one, it's a lot of, like, short essay-type things and document-type things, like the protocols of the Elder's Designs, like a whole chapter in it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then there's a chapter where he talks about ufology and really goes after the people in ufology, and that's where he brings up the aviary and lists about eight names in ufology that everybody pretty much knows, and says they're the aviary and they're with the government. And it was really,
but the aviary was something Bill and Jamie made up. It was never any official group.
Yeah, see, that's what I was gonna. That's like sort of the question was. He seemed to like take an extreme point of view, and then it seemed
he did that in everything.
It seemed that at some point he turned on ufology, where he stopped trusting like everybody in the field.
Well, it sounds like a classic paranoid thing where you suddenly think everybody's after you.
And
they were. They just didn't want to listen to him because it was so annoying. And he read it as, oh, they all hate me and they've turned against me.
And so the aviary was Bill Moore and Shandera, that was their way of talking about the people.
Yeah, they just
working
as far as I've been able to determine, and you know, I've never heard anything different except from people that have come up with stuff that makes no sense whatsoever to me, was that they were using these bird names because they wanted to be able to talk about, you know, Richard Doty and this Falcon character and Robert Collins and I think Ernie Kellerstrauss was one of them who's in that book, Exempt from Disclosure. Hal Putoff was one of them, I believe. These are all these people that were in this group that was trying to find either putting out disinformation or trying to find out what the disinformation was from whatever angle they could come at it.
Yeah, so people who were hip to what was going on.
Yeah, just their networks, people who were communicating across, you know, privately by phone and mail and all this at the time. And they could say, well, you know, Owl says this, but Falcon says this. And, you know, if somebody was listening in on them, they wouldn't know what the hell they were talking about.
Now, what about the guy who's kind of lumped in with Bill Cooper in the book, John Lear? He sort of reemerged in the last 2 years or so. What was the story with him back in the day, back during this whole saga? Because at some point he seems to have disappeared off the UFO radar, and now he's back.
Well, because there was other things he needed to do, or he got tired of it. And so I saw John Lear speak a few times. He was a guy that went up there with a bunch of guards around him.
Yeah, yeah.
He had like these big burly security guards stand around him during his lectures to make it look like he was saying stuff that was going to be very dangerous and he was going to get, you know, assassinated for it. Now, and he was standing like 5 feet above them, which gave anybody a clear shot, which seemed kind of silly. But anyway, I think he was one of the first people that came out and talked to Paul Benowitz about what he was finding out, what he thought was going on. And actually, Paul became annoyed with him because Lear wanted to hear all the most lurid stuff, but he didn't give him anything back, and he said, I'm going to go out and talk about this, and you know, and I think that's incredible, and I think at one point Lear lied to him or something. Anyway, he got Paul mad at him, and he stopped talking to him. But he was one of the first people to listen to Paul Benowitz and take his information and try to start doing something with it. Making announcements about it, because Benowitz wasn't really a publicity hound. He was trying to find out what was going on and see if he could do something about it personally. He didn't care about, you know, going on a lecture circuit or you know, having movies made about him or anything like that. Lear, on the other hand, I think was very interested in that kind of thing, whether he admitted it to himself or not. And I think he developed some contacts with some of the same people that Benowitz was talking to, and they kept telling him the same story, so he would spread these stories through the UFO community and confuse and discredit people. And he did that for a while, and then kind of, you know, after the novelty of what he was saying faded off and people were tired of hearing it, he stopped. He didn't have the best story, you know. He didn't have the story to top the other stories anymore. The funny thing is I saw him last year, or 2 years ago at the crash retrieval conference that Bob and Ryan Wood put on. I was speaking at it. He walked in, and everybody immediately crowded around him, and he was all smiles and shaking hands and all that. And I said, "Hey, you know what? You're in the book I'm writing. It's going to come out." And he said, "Really?" I said, "I don't know if it's a very flattering picture. I'm sorry to say." And he said, "That's okay. I'd love to see it." Okay, this seems fair, but I haven't heard anything from him since then.
Yeah, I just got into this like the last 3 years or so. I never heard of him until he showed up on the Art Bell show about 2 years ago, November 2003.
Did he say anything new?
Yeah, he had
I guess he would have, otherwise he wouldn't come on.
Yeah, he was all about how there should be no disclosure because the people couldn't handle it. And talked a lot.
Oh, yeah, that sounds typical.
He talked about a lot of the stuff from...
except for him, because he can handle it.
Yeah, that's kind of what he said. He got out of ufology because he couldn't do it because he was a pilot. And then this is like really what I can remember from the top of my head. And he gave this thing called the Lear test. Did you ever hear about that?
No.
Where he gave like a quasi-briefing to Bell. And it was long, maybe 15 minutes long. And then he sort of was like, "So what do? Do you disclose it or not?" It was under the idea that the government brings you in and gives you this briefing, which he theoretically like gave to Bell, and then asked Bell if he would disclose or not. And it was this really over the top briefing that was really negative and just you know just extreme. The aliens are just awful type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been here forever, and they created religion and all this stuff, and then of course Bell.
Who knows? Maybe they did.
Yeah, you know, but it was other stuff too. The underground bases. It was all. You can find it if you do a web search for Lear test, probably. And anyway, so Bell said no, and then it sort of became like a funny little Bell standard. Whenever he'd have UFO guests on, he'd play the Lear test, and they'd talk about it for a good half hour at least.
Well, it's a good gimmick. That's why he came on.
I think so. It was, yeah, because he was hyping it for a good hour before he did it, and then he did it, and then I always kind of found it funny that at the end of the interview, he said he was going to fade back into obscurity, and Bell said, "Is this the last time we'll speak with you?" And he said, "Yeah, this is the last time," and then he was on again
back.
6 months.
What?
6 months later, he came back on the show.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but
I didn't know about that. Immediately I said, "Oh, he'll be back."
Oh, yeah. So I kind of laughed about that. Because at that point I'm like, well, if he said that, I'm already, you know.
Well, Art Bell said he was quitting radio, too, and he came back.
Okay, the next, let's see here. How riddled with disinformation and his disinfo agents and stuff is ufology today, do you think?
Not nearly as much as it used to be, but probably still some.
You think that's because the Cold War ended and...
Yeah, I think that's the main reason. I think people are more interested, the government's more interested in Middle Eastern terrorists now than they are in people hanging around military bases and taking it back to Russia. I don't think that, as far as I know, I don't think that Middle Eastern terrorists operate that way. They just come in and bomb things. They don't really need to know about what kind of planes and rockets we're using.
Well, do you think there's people in the field that are just there to throw off the rest of the field at the behest of the government?
Maybe. I don't think they're, you know what, I was about to say I don't think there ever was, but the thing is that the people were in there to throw off people at the behest of the government, but they didn't know they were doing it, which is the best kind.
So do you think that's going on?
I'm not so sure. I think it's a lot. If it's going on at all, it's very minor now.
Oh, really?
I mean, that's just my feeling. I mean, I can't explain to you, except for what I just said, why that is.
Yeah.
But there's still people around that were active in that at the time, and they're still ufologists, and they're still doing things. But I don't know there hasn't been too much. You know, there's not a big thing about underground bases right now. All the exciting stuff that's going on happens to, you know, everybody hears about stuff, and luckily and refreshingly, it's coming from Mexico, South America, other areas of the world. All the most, you know, the most sensationalistic stuff now. And very interesting stuff. I think that was there's kind of a clarion call or whatever, dinner bell. Not really a dinner bell, but the kind of the announcement that all this stuff was going on in Mexico City about 10 years ago and is still going on, signaled a shift of whatever the phenomenon is to some other area. And since the United States can't really latch, none of the military or intelligence people here can latch on to any of that stuff, they just generally leave it alone. I mean, I can't think of anything really spectacular that's come out in the last 10 or 12 years in the United States. Well, maybe, so say the last 5 years in the United States that would be something that could be used as a hook, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Paul Benowitz was very convenient. And the fact that a lot of other people picked that up was very convenient as well, because the people that clustered around that might not be actual, real, patriotic American citizens.
Now, actually, I want to kind of scroll back to a sort of a Bill Moore question, but do you think that as a result of what he did and how he came out, people are more cautious in ufology about everything, or at least the serious researchers?
They were right after he said it, even though they wouldn't admit it. Because they didn't want to admit that he had said something that, you know, that would guide their thinking. I think he probably single-handedly made everybody a lot more careful. Even if they hated him, they were a lot more careful about where stuff came from and what they did with it. With the exception of a few people like Lear and Bill Cooper. But, you know, rank and file, most people were just a little bit more careful about who they were talking to and what they believed. I went through the same thing. I had some guy come to me who said he was from Naval Intelligence and told me all kinds of scary things.
Really?
I was totally paranoid for about a year. I thought people were, you know, watching my house and, you know, calling, you know, tapping my phone and constantly.
Well, tell me a little bit about this, because that's interesting if you want to, if you can.
Yeah, sure.
From Naval Intelligence, how did they contact you?
Through a friend of mine he had, like, gathered this group of people, like, kind of not very famous people that were interested in UFOs in the Southern California area. My friend Richard had known him, and then there was a few other people. Melinda Leslie knew him pretty well.
Oh, I know Melinda.
Yeah. If you ask her about Mike, what was his name? I can't remember his last name, but ask her if she remembers Mike, she'll tell you.
Okay.
He started meeting with us and calling me and leaking things to me to put in the magazine, which I did a couple of times, and basically telling it, you know, the first thing he told me was, "I've read your stuff and I think it's good." It sounds exactly like what happened to Bill.
Yeah.
I said, "Oh yeah." I said, "How'd you get a hold of it all?" And he said, "You've written about UFOs, right?" "Yeah." And he said, "Well, there's a file. I can just pull it up and look at it all."
Huh.
Everything you've written. I was like, you know, and at that time I was like, you know, for one thing, it's kind of flattering, and for two, it's like paranoia-inducing. It's two-pronged attack.
Yeah.
You know, pumping your ego in a positive and negative way at the same time. So then, of course, he gave me these huge things that he'd written or said he'd written. I still have them, too. About UFOs, what the government did with them, military-industrial complex, what they were doing, what Area 51 was about, the history of mind control, all kinds of stuff in this huge mix. And
wow.
Actually, in the first installment he gave me, he actually used the term excluded middle.
Really?
Just basically, as probably a little thing out to me saying, you know, little props out to me saying, okay. He used it in another, he kind of used it in a slightly different context, but the same idea about, you know, kind of stepping back and looking at the positive and negative aspects of something, the things you don't agree with and things you do agree with at the same time to see what can happen. Very slowly wove me into his web and then started telling me really scary things about how my mind could be controlled without knowing it, and how cellular towers are being used just really insane things. And of course, you know, this information, he would tell me a few things. One, first he made me feel good, then he would tell me things I knew about already, and he'd show me documents that actually proved it, and then he'd start going into speculation because he already had me in that net
Yeah.
of believing what he said. you know, as like, well, I'm getting information from the inside. I never went out and stood out and said, I've been told this, and you're being watched, and your cellular towers are controlling your brain and all this. Because I you know, in one part of my, I mean, I was just like, I can't go out and say this. I mean,
yeah.
You know, there's no way for me to prove it. But his point was to try and get me, and I still can't figure out why the hell he was talking to me. I really don't. And then we find out later he probably wasn't really in naval intelligence, yet he knew things he shouldn't know. So he knew somebody somewhere that knew what was going on. This story gets far deeper than I want to get into it with on your show.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's cool.